who have one particular understanding of what Einstein was saying think that there is a definitely a electromagnetic wave and gravity interaction. It's a very weak interaction in most circumstances. When you get something massive as the sun, it starts becoming quite measurable. When you come up to something as extremely massive as a galactic cluster, where there are black holes, where there are supermassive black holes in the middle of each one of those galaxies of that galactic cluster, that's now an extremely strong local gravity field generating object, essentially midway between you and some very other distant light-emitting object. We'll dig a little bit deeper into this one. It's not going to be an easy one to settle, obviously. Like many situations, there's more than one explanation. But Paul's going to straighten this all out for us. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. No, I don't think so. I'm one of the people that don't even believe in math. I think it's probably all string theory. So, I think equals MC squared. M is really just a representation of waves. That's why they have the problem with the is mass or atoms. You know, does it predict their, you know, do they act like waves or mass or waves? You know, there's electromagnetic theory, is that a wave, is that mass? I'm going to say it's all string theory. They're all waves. Well, I'm here to talk about STS-130. I won't do it too much because, you know, we haven't heard much of Mel. I think I wind up a little long-winded here on these topics, but I know we talked about this topic before, about what they're going to be doing on February 7th, as long as there's no delay. Let me drop it. You're going to have a six-person crew taking probably, looks like the last big construction piece up for the International Space Station. It's pretty well built. They need to have a couple more flights to resupply it or keep, you know, extra things on station in case they fail when the shuttle is going to eventually retire. We won't have any American flights that are manned going up there until probably 5 years or so from now. So, but this is like the last of the big, you know, this, to me this is the final piece. This big node is like the length of a, like if you were looking at a soda can, you know, maybe shorten it down a little bit, that type of a physical structure. It kind of looks like a cylinder, except it's got a bunch of ports all over it, you know, six different ports. And on one of the ports, they're going to attach, or they have attached the cupola. Cupola is a six-sided, six windows, trapezoidal-looking windows. And then in the middle of that, you have roughly a three-foot diameter window there, so it's like seven windows. All of them have this outside cover that could be open and closed. So, I mean, if you ever wanted to change the glass in the future, you would, for instance, close these outside pieces to close off the glass, and you could actually physically change the glass out without depressurizing the International Space Station. You'll be able to have two people looking out these windows at the same time. You float up into it, and you'll be able to look at the Earth and the spaceships that are coming or leaving, the ones that will be manned or unmanned. You'll be like a little control tower. So it's good to, you know, be good to see this thing completed. Let me drop it, WS2M. It's interesting to look at the crew patch. You know, they have a patch for every flight. Since they've been doing all these space flights, you know, everybody has their own particular patch. If you look at the one that they have, bring that up by, you know, going to NASA or whatever, you put in STS 130 crew patch or logo. You can see what they have. They have the symbol of the this cupola, as if you're looking out the window, the six-sided structure. And if you will to be looking through it, you're looking down at Earth. And the picture that they're using of Earth is an actual picture. It's the first picture of Earth taken from the moon on one of the unmanned orbiters. It was a lunar orbiter, one flight. It was taken back in August of 1966. So they're using that picture of Earth as if you're looking through the glass. And you have the different astronauts' names, you know, surrounding that six-sided piece. You know, since there are six sides and there are six astronauts, it worked out pretty good. Yeah, you have Zamka, Burtz, woman Heyer, Patrick, Bienken, and Robinson. You have the six names, one on each side. So it's a pretty interesting looking logo patch that they designed for this. So I'll probably cut that out and put it up with my other patches from earlier flights, you know, such as the first six manned flights up there. I'll put this one up, like, kind of like a completion of all the different space flights that have come since, you know, since the earlier times. Back to you, WS2.
Thank you, Paul. Paul, how many more shuttle flights are scheduled? Was there an extension of the time when the shuttle is cut off and we have to be thoroughly dependent on Soviet vehicles? So how many more shuttles, and was there any extension of the time that we're going to be using the shuttles? Over to you, Paul.
Russian, not Soviet.
I think there's probably four flights left. That's it. And when they made the decision a few years ago to do away with the shuttle in 2010, that was really that wasn't written in stone. They had a certain amount of flights that they had to complete the space station. Now that's the goal. We owe it to all the different partners, the 16 different countries that are involved with the International Space Station to complete what we said we would. So, is there a delay? Yeah, it might drift into a little bit into 2011 because the flights have been delayed somewhat, but the scheduling, the manifest for each flight hasn't changed. The crews that are going up have been selected. They haven't been scratched. The people that have been chosen to go will go. So if it drifts into 2011 a little bit, it might. That's a possibility. But since they decided on canceling the shuttle program, you really have a situation where they needed to do all these different flights to complete the station. I guess that's the, you know, it's good and it's bad. Yeah, I mean, it might drift into 2011 a little bit, shorten the time between now and the Constellation program. You know, not good. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a couple of more extensions, but that's not going to happen. I don't think that's not in the cards. WS1.
And one last question, Paul. You probably told us before, and I may have forgotten. I've definitely forgotten. So we have four flights to go of the shuttle. After that, right now, there is a hard stop of shuttle use. The replacement vehicle is how many years downrange? And to go along with what Ed is saying, we will be using Russian spacecraft instead for roughly what length of time? Over to you, Paul.
Your earliest flight, if things went smoothly, which they tend not to, would be probably the end of 2014. probably more like 2015 for the earliest flight. And even then, there'll be just flights up to, the space station. You probably won't be seeing manned flights to the moon, which is the ultimate goal. And of course, beyond that, they have long-term goals of using the same spacecraft for Mars flights. So I would say you're going to see probably at least a 5-year gap for manned flights to the space station. You will have Russia, of course, bringing people up. And there's this other company, SpaceX, not too far from Cocoa Beach down in Florida, not too far from there, but they're preparing to eventually launch people. They're going to have a first unmanned test, I think, next year. And possibly the hope is to have private industry launching people. I wouldn't hold my breath for that, but I mean, that there's a possibility there, Dick. Back to you.
Is it me, or is that embarrassing?
It's certainly less than desirable, Ed. You're absolutely right. The fact that we abandon our main space bus, our method of lifting large objects into space safely with astronaut assistance, the fact that we abandon that some number of years before we have the replacement. We're almost burning the bridge before we got a place to go. And yes, I think that's embarrassing. That's less than desirable without a doubt, Ed. Thank you, Paul.
And elevator.
Yeah, the space elevator is a beautiful sounding concept. But just like a space-based solar-powered satellite system, space solar power getting down to Earth. Again, beautiful ideas on paper. I'm very skeptical that the people within my voice right now are going to see that happen within their lifetime. That's my belief. I may be wrong. I'd like to be wrong. But I think the space elevator, there's a lot of things that are not ironed out with it yet. Like, how does it survive a hurricane, a meteorite impact, an impact with an aircraft? How do you establish that hardware out there in the first place? Are you sure you can make a 40,000 mile long ribbon out of graphite reinforced materials that will survive continuous ultraviolet exposure and hard exposure to space vacuum without deteriorating while holding up a many, many kilogram mass?
Lightning,
that's another good point. So there's a lot of things to worry about with the space-based elevator. Great concept, but I'm doubtful. And I'm also telling Wesley to please stay healthy, think good thoughts, eat lots of vegetables, get a lot of sleep, do a lot of hydrating, go easy on low-sodium food, eating only low-sodium foods. I want him to stay healthy so that I can ask him in the year 2016, when he predicted that we will be on the moon, and I'll give him a little leeway, maybe even 2017. He thinks man's going to be back on the moon around 2016. I told him on that year I'm going to come and ask him about that, because I am skeptical. I don't think the United States and the world is going to finance that. Not enough payoff for the number of dollars required. But that's just a belief on my part. We really should go over now to what we've been delaying for many weeks. Mel's got quite a pile of wood mail. We should at least attack some of the good ones there, some of the big ones. K2KEY, which are the burning ones you think we should handle tonight, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Unfortunately, we've lost most of our audience. You want to say that, because I've gotten a lot of emails saying no longer will they bother, and emails have dropped off, I'd say considerably, Dick. I only got a few. I answered a few from some of the younger people, and the other one said that they don't even listen much to the TechNet. I've got about 50 of them that says they no longer are interested because you've gotten away from the original concept like you, so we never promised them anything, but they had hope that, you know, we would continue simple explanations to a number of things. They were very interested in the discussion, the last discussion that we had about almost a month ago now on vellum. And I don't even remember where we left off on it, to tell you the truth. And I had they have sent me a number of questions on vellum, but never got to them, Dick. So I haven't looked at it recently, really, to tell you the truth, other than peruse over some of them and gave some simple answers. But there's no way I could, you know, have accomplished the entire comments that I've gotten in the last 3 weeks over.
Well, there have been two times in the past when a particular group of people said, gee, we're going too far away from ham radio subjects. I'm going to stop listening to the TechNet. And some of those people did go away, and some of them came back. So we do the best we can, and we know that ahead of time we can't please everybody. Of the ones that you have answered, use your memory, Mel. What were the subjects that they were asking questions on? Maybe you and I should have a live discussion right now on that subject to help illuminate it a little bit. So even if you don't have your list in front of you, of the ones you've already answered, what were some of those questions? Where do you think information is required? K2KEY, give us a little more audio. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, most of the comment comes from the fact that we said we'd set aside a period of time, say at 11 o'clock, once a week to take care of questions of that type, which we have not, I could say, fulfilled in quite a while. What was one of the questions? Well, there were questions about making, the last questions I remember, was questions about making vellums yourself, rolling your own, and what experience and how to go about it. And there were some questions about certain, what kind of materials, about companies that supply and which was better, questions about putting up, we started to talk about antennas that using controlled theta radiation. We had, remember, gotten into that about talking about experiments that using part of the feed line in some cases where we installed the choking device, that we could actually have some kind of a vertical incident on the antenna, which could be desirable in certain cases. And then there was questions that came in, you know, that one that I had a number I was going to use next after we finished with Dallin, was basically a discussion of what is the basic information that you understand about receiver specifications, Dick, over.
Okay, let's take these one at a time. In the case of a Dallin, that a person decides to roll his own, and the easiest and cheapest and nicest way to roll your own is the so-called poor man's Dallin. That's the one where you take some number of turns of, let's say, your input coaxial cable, might be RG8, might be RG58, and you coil those number of turns close to the antenna and tape them together. And the first question a person might ask is, how many turns, what diameter, how do I know when I've done enough, and what's the theory of its operation? And here's the way I go about it. It's not the only way. I'd like to believe there's a section of the Radio Amateur's Handbook or the ARRL antenna book that covers this. And maybe they just simply say, make it four turns of 8-inch diameter and tape it together with black electrical tape. Maybe they say something as simple as that. But for the guy who's a little bit more of a scientist, how does he know when he's done enough? And here's one possible answer. Assume I've got a 50-ohm transmission line, and I've got a 50-ohm antenna. But the transmission line is unbalanced. That means that most of the RF energy is on the center conductor, and that RF energy is between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer conductor of the coaxial cable. In other words, the radio field is supposed to all be contained inside the cable. And until you get to the antenna with a properly installed connector, that is true. Then you get to the antenna, which might be a thoroughly balanced antenna. A pure dipole, or a pure dipole that's a driven element of a Yagi, as an example. And the way the dipole itself acts, it demands that the signal going to it be reasonably balanced. Therefore, if you're putting 10 volts on the dipole will force the 10 volts to be deranged this way. At one instant in time, there'll be plus 5 volts on the right-hand side of the dipole and minus 5 volts on the left-hand side of the dipole. There's a 10-volt differential, but all of a sudden there's minus 5 volts on the left-hand side during this portion of the cycle of RF energy, and the minus 5 volts on the left-hand side connected to the shield is now going to, for the first time, it's going to walk down the outside of that shield. And now your coaxial cable, the outer shield, is part of your antenna. That RF energy crawls down that cable, comes into the shack, gives you RF in the shack, the cable itself radiating, changes the pattern you think you had, and if that cable goes alongside of the 60-cycle wiring and the apartment of the television set of your neighbor, it can create television interference. Let me drop. Okay, so you want to stop that from happening. The antenna itself is approximately 50 ohms. If the outside of the coax cable acted like it was part of an RF choke, and an RF choke is really something that just has a high impedance at your RF frequency. It tries to act like an open circuit. And where's the beginning of that open circuit? Okay, if the outside of the cable on a 50 ohm antenna was 10 times higher than 50 ohms, 500 ohms, if you had 500 ohms of inductive reactance in that poor man's choking balance, you're at the threshold of doing some good things. At 3.5 megacycles, one of the lowest frequencies most of us are likely to use, 500 ohms of inductive reactance, something like 22.7 millihenry. Microhenry. 22.7 microhenry. That's the beginning of enough. More than that is better. So at least 22.7, call it 23 microhenries. You'd like to have at least 23 microhenries. If you go to the appropriate chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook on inductors, capacitors, and resistors, there's a beautiful formula there where you plug in the diameter or the radius, I'm not sure which, of your coil, assuming you're winding it as a solenoid coil, and you're going to really place your turns very close together. They're in direct contact, held together with your black tape. But you choose what you believe is a reasonable diameter for rolling your coax cable for this choke near the antenna. Choose some reasonable number of turns, maybe 4 turns, 5 turns, and you plug in that formula. The length of the coil, that's going to be, the length is going to be, since they're in direct contact with each other, 5 thicknesses of the coax cable. It's going to be the length of the solenoid-shaped coil. And in my example, maybe you've chosen 8 inches of diameter. And 5 turns. You plug in the 5 turns, the 8 inches diameter, and maybe the total length is going to be 2 inches. You plug that in, and it'll tell you exactly how many microhenries you're going to get from that formula. And is that more than 22.7 microhenries? If it's less, you know you need more turns. And the inductance goes up approximately as the number of turns squared. And I think the inductance also goes up approximately as the diameter of the coil squared. So at 3.5 megacycles, you can easily calculate whether or not your poor man's balance is adequate. And if you put more turns in that, the more is better. Once you see the process by which you do that, let me drop. If you're doing it on 10 meters, 28 megacycles, instead of 3.5 megacycles, 28 megacycles instead of 3.5, that ratio is 8. So therefore, 8 times less microhenries will do it. 2.8 microhenries will do it. So now you know how many microhenries minimum you would like the outside of the coax cable to act like when you make this RF choke. And so step by step, you can calculate, you can go to the reactance chart, or you can take my word for it, 22.7 microhenries at 3.5 megacycles is an inductive reactance of 500 ohms. And everything's proportional from there. double the frequency, you get twice the number of ohms of inductive reactance for the same number of microhenries. It goes up linearly with frequency, the inductive reactance. So you can calculate ahead of time your poor man's balance. Is it enough? I wonder if that somewhat gives them information that might help them. Now, K2KEY, K2RIW.
2πFL. This is K2KEY. Well, the different balance that you are talking about, the common mode choke balance, would present a little bit of a problem as far as I'm concerned on the dipole operating at 3.5 megahertz because according to the chart, it does require a lot of coax hanging up there. According to the chart I have here, using RG213 or RG8 for 3.5 to make a common mode choke would require 22 feet of the coax rolled into 8 turns. So that would present, you know, quite a bungle up there. However, there are some better fixes that I think have been around now. Of course, you can buy some nice already commercially made balance. Amazon, a company called Amazon, offers a couple of very good alternatives. One is, of course, they have their RF choke type, which is a consists of beaded balun, where you have a whole gang of beads that they call it their beaded balun system, and they just put them on the coax before you put the connector on or before you join it onto the antenna. And then they also offer a very nice kit to wind a balun for specific instances, and also a method of even testing your final product, Dick, over.
Yeah, Howie mentioned something that I forgot to say. You can calculate how much inductive reactance you get from a particular number of microhenries, or henries, and you have to plug the formula in with henries, 2πFL. In other words, inductive reactance in ohms equals 2 times pi times frequency in hertz times L, which means inductance in henry. So plug in henries and hertz. 3.5 megahertz, by the way, is 3.5 exponential 6, the 6 zeros in a megacycle. And a microhenry, for instance, is a, if you had 28 microhenries, it would be 28 times exponential minus 6. And you plug in, and pi, of course, is 3.14. So 2 pi FL, you multiply those four factors together when you know inductance and you know frequency, and it tells you how much inductive reactance you're going to get in the subject of ohms. There's also a nice chart in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, which gives you frequency on one axis, reactance on the other axis, and a whole bunch of 45-degree lines where each line has got a certain number of microhenries associated with that line. So it's a nomograph. So it's making this all come together is pretty doable. Let me drop. And to do that at 28 megacycles is fairly easy. All of that feed of coax of the poor man's balun at 3.5 megs, if you're suspending the dipole only by the tips, and that coil of wire plus the rest of your transmission line is hanging from the center, yes, that could be kind of a mechanical kludge and kind of a heavy structure. You can do it. It's less than ideal. But about a third of us set up an 80-meter dipole by having some kind of a support in the center, an inverted V, and we slope it downward. So either a tree or a tower or something is in the center of the dipole. And if now the center of the dipole is being supported, putting a 20 feet of coax cable together in a coil, and only required that big up at 3.5, down way down at 3.5 megacycles, putting that kludge suspended from the tower or from the tree is, in my opinion, very doable. That's one approach. The other approach Mel is mentioning is the Amadon company. I think Unadilla is another company. I think W2AD. There's a number of companies that make ballooning structures which are simultaneously a beautiful mechanical support, where this is this white tubular object, probably 2.5 inches in diameter, and maybe it's about 10 inches long. At the bottom, it's got a UHF, a PL-259 or SO-239 connector, and at the top of it, it's got a hook, a screw eye, ready for holding it up, suspending it. And on the left side and the right side, it has two other eyes coming out where you actually connect the center of your dipole and solder it down, wrap it, and solder it. So mechanically, and weatherproofing, that's a very nice, convenient thing to use. And do you want to spend the money and go out and buy one of those? It's a worthwhile purchase. But making the coax ballon the way we're mentioning, again, is quite doable. You got multiple choices there. And I've forgotten what the second subject is we're supposed to be discussing now. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Okay, as Dick just said, there are several methods of doing this type of ballon type of device. Now, he did allude to the fact, and I just mentioned also the B, known as basically is the W2DU ballon. Now, the W2DU ballon, one of the originals, originated actually by W2DU, who was Walt Maxwell. And his idea was to choke it off. It's very simple. It is a piece of coax cable, and inside, on the outside of the coax cable, usually enclosed inside of a cylinder like Dick mentioned, there is a whole gang of beads that run a length of cable, and now is very nicely packaged, as Dick just mentioned, with a connector on the bottom. You could also purchase that bead separate. That's a nice part of it, because you can, in certain instances, put the ballon not at the antenna, but as we started to discuss, what we call control feeder radiation. Very interesting experiment that was done by, who was it done? It was by Barney. Yeah, I believe it was Barney who came up with the G5RV. And his experiment was to make the antenna, the part of the antenna desirable to make it the feed line as part of the antenna. In other words, possibly partial radiation of the feed line, something that we thought we'd want to choke off right at the antenna place. However, he found that he could do that in some way, have some kind of a control directional situation with the dipole that he wasn't able to achieve because he couldn't swing the dipole around. So what he did is actually took these beads. Let me let it drop. This is an interesting experiment you can do. You can buy the bead package from Amadon. You could fly these beads down the coax a distance and see if you can get some kind of effect such as that was mentioned in the article. In other words, controlled feeder radiation. And that's possible, very possible, by using the DU method, because you can move the bead physically down the coax and don't have to cut the coax if you decide you want to move it to another spot on the coax. So that is, that is basically some very interesting sort of off-the-beaten-path use of a ballon. There is other ways, of course, with the standard ways of using the ferrite core type ballons that we did start to talk about. There is also some other interesting ballons that were really found to be very interesting for use on the VHF band, known as the sleeve ballon, which I don't think we ever got to Dick over.
Yeah, the Slee Balin is sometimes called a bazooka balin because it looks a little bit like that military weapon. And the taking the toroid donut-shaped cores and sliding them on the end of the coax cable, if you use them directly at the antenna for that kind of a balin, similar to the W2DU, I call it AD, W2DU balin, the Walt Maxwell balin, Amidon, Unidella, a number of companies make things like that. You could also, if you want to, open up the connector in the shack and slide the ferrite toroid cores up from the bottom if you wanted to, because you don't want to disconnect the assembly you've got at the top of the antenna when you add this baloning structure. You may have a beautiful soldered connection, you don't want to disturb it, so you can slide them in from the other end. And I guess there's a slim possibility if you buy large enough ones, they might even fit over the connector that's in the shack. That's not as likely. So there's lots of ways of doing it. And you can wind the balun itself as turns of wire on the properly chosen ferrite core. And those turns of wire could be nice, thick, enameled, covered wire, maybe 14 gauge. And you can make a poor man's equivalent of enameled wire by taking 14 gauge household wire with its rubber insulation on it. Even though it's not intended for RF purposes, that rubber insulation, the way the actual signal, let me drop, the way the signal travels down the actual wire itself with that rubber insulation on the outside of it, I'm reasonably sure the signal would not see the rubber, so to speak. Yeah, I'm reasonably sure that's true. But if you think it's going to, you can slide off the rubber that was supplied by the Romex cable manufacturer and slide on some Teflon spaghetti tubing. And the Teflon tubing is definitely an RF product. So you can make a poor man's equivalent of enameled wire out of the materials you got. Or actually go out and buy enameled wire of the right diameter. So winding your own balun is an approach. You mentioned an article by Lou Varney in which he intentionally allowed the coax cable to be partially radiating by sliding the ferrite beads down the coaxial cable away from the antenna a given length, like maybe a quarter wavelength or a half wavelength. Do you happen to know where that article is, Mel? And I'll get back to the sleeve balun on the next transmission. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Where do I have it? I have it someplace. I read a very interesting article how he came up with this, because he had a situation where his dipole was not favoring a direction that he wanted to emphasize, and he couldn't turn it. He didn't have the room, he says, to be able to turn the dipole, and he did come up with this idea. I have to find the exact article. I remember reading it, and it's most likely in that pile of papers of the books and books. I could say I got a stack on antennas. If you took the books written by Maxwell and the books by J.K. John Kraus and all the others, and you stack them at 18 inches high of antenna, you can well imagine how many different versions of antennas and antenna applications there are. When you look at this mountain, it takes up a shelf, literally, thick, almost, just that alone. So as we were saying, there is a number of different versions of it. In winding the balun, if you're going to roll your own, what I do suggest, in fact, now I'll quote Jerry Civic, who became a silent P, unfortunately, only a couple of weeks ago. Jerry Civic found that the best wire to use on his balun, in fact, the ones that he did all his experiments later on was with a wire that is called a thermalized wire. It's basically a wire that was developed for putting through ductwork and all. It, because of a fire situation, it will not smolder. called thermalized wire, which now I understand that gets fairly easy to obtain over.
Rather interesting. Thermalized wire. That's one approach. The enamel itself, when you buy enameled wire, in my mind is a pretty good RF substance. It doesn't give you excess heating and can tolerate some very high temperatures. I think most likely, unless you're running a multiple kilowatts, the rubber that's on the wire itself when you get it from Romex cable and peel it away, I think would work very nicely. But if you have doubt, you can always cover your 14-gauge wire or whatever you're using to wind your balun with Teflon spaghetti tubing to make it insulated and a purely RF savvy object. Jerry Civic was W2FMI, Whiskey 2 Frank Mike India, I believe is his call letters, and he's written a lot of articles and books that you can buy on balloning devices, and he's given some nice explanations. He's even got tapes or CD-ROMs on the subject of balance. Let me drop. Now, the article by Lou Varney, I'm going to guess it most likely appeared in QST magazine. So if a person already is an ARRL member, and he goes to ARRL.org, www.arrl.org, and does a literature search with the name Lou Varney, V-A-R-N-I-E, or is it V-A-R-N-E-Y? You're going to tell us the spelling. Quite possibly you will find this article in that archive at the ARRL site, if it was a QST article. So let me pass it back to you, Mel. Do you remember it likely being a QST article? K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, it was not an article in QST. This I can be sure of. You know, Lou Varney did write a separate series of articles, but it was not for QST. And it mostly, I think, because of his call, G5, the G5 call, his G5RV call, I would bet it could have been the Radio Society of Great Britain, Dick, over.
Okay. How did you get that particular copy of the RSGB bulletin on that subject, Mel? Go ahead.
I did get, I could say, been, you know, interested for many years in tennis. I guess we both paralleled a lot of experiments, a lot of ideas, and a lot of interest in tennis. So wherever I saw something that was, you know, available in print on antennas, I surely bought the book or got the clippings or whatever, because I've got a lot of loose clippings and things like that. Things that were from the IEEE, proceedings of the IEEE, et cetera, et cetera, and then stuff that came in, like there was a, I believe it was an antenna issue that the RSGB had. Most likely, that's where I read it, Dick. It's one of those sources, but I'm sure it was not QST, over.
Now, Lou Varney's G5RV dipole is so popular, I think there's a high probability that that design itself is in the ARRL antenna book. So that's a question. First of all, do you think it's in the antenna book? And if so, it is possible that this additional information on the balloning function is also in that book, the Lou Varney information. On top of that, the archives at ARRL doesn't cover just QST. It also covers QST, ham radio, and it might cover certain issues of RSGB, Radio Society of Great Britain. Back to you for any comments on that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Possibility. I have seen some articles, I could say, that they chronicled on other magazines. I don't know, really, tell you the truth, Dick, whether or not how much of Lou Varney's work other than the G5RV, which is highlighted in the antenna book, because that's what he's most famous for, of course, for the G5RV antenna system, which, of course, is not actually an his real purity of his G5RV did not use coaxial cable. Remember, this work was done, basically coax was just coming into its own. Most hams don't realize that in the 30s and into the 40s, especially in the 30s, there was no coax really available as general use to hams. In the 40s, during World War II, when it was becoming popular again, ham radio really didn't have much of a place where an outlet where you could purchase it, especially during the Second World War. It was almost impossible to get any kind of radio part. And so at the end of World War II, when the surplus market, you know, came aboard, when coax by the millions of feet were being released by the government, and I have some samples of the coax, if you want to call it, I mean, coax that was made with silk covering, you know, with woven covering and all, and it's quite a departure. I've showed it to some people, and they said, that's coax. And I said, yeah, that was coax of World War II. Lou Varney's work, basically, on his G5RV did not originally, you know, show any kind of a coaxial antenna system that was added later on to make it more convenient for a lot of hams to connect the end of the, you know, G5RV with the 450 ohm feeders to a Bowerling device that then let coax bring into the shack. Over.
Yeah, I think there's a version that many people build of the G5RV, which starts off with a dipole of just the right length, fed with twin lead, and then a certain length of twin lead is used up to the transition to coax. In some cases, I think people make that transition to coax with just a hard connection between the open wire line and the shield and center conductor of the coax cable, and then proceed to the rest of the distance to the shack with the coaxial cable. I guess other people will put some kind of a balancing device there, something to convert the unbalanced coax cable into the balanced feed, which is the ideal way of feeding the open wire transmission line that then feeds the dipole. Now, the other subject you wanted to talk about is the sleeve balun or bazooka balun. And remember now that what we're trying to do is to make the outside of the coax cable act like an open circuit at our RF frequency. That sounds crazy at first, let me drop it. Because you're trying to feed a signal to your antenna where you could simplistically say the signal is going down the center conductor through the antenna and then coming back to the outer shield of the coax cable as a return. That's not quite what's going on, but you could simplistically look at it that way to complete the circuit. And you want that return signal to only favor the inside of the cable, not the outside of the cable. Well, to make that happen, you leave the inside of the cable alone, but you want the outside of the cable to act like an open circuit, to be choked of any RF current flowing down it. And one way to do that is to put this bazooka or sleeve-like device, which really consists of another diameter of outer shield so that your coax cable becomes triaxial. So you've got a center conductor, you've got an outer shield, and then you have an outer-outer shield. The outer-outer shield is only exactly a quarter wavelength long. It goes right up to the antenna, open-circuited. The outer-outer shield is an open circuit at the antenna. It proceeds, insulated from the real outer shield, a quarter wavelength down, and then makes electrical contact between the outer-outer conductor and the coaxial cable outer conductor. And there's various ways you construct that. That bazooka or sleeve-like device could be a slightly larger diameter piece of brass tubing in the case of VHF operation, with a type N connector or an SO239 mounted in the bottom of its center. That's one approach. But there's many ways you can do it. Just by cutting through the outer polyethylene jacket a quarter wavelength down and soldering the outer-outer shield to the outer conductor is one approach. So what that does is it recognizes, let me drop, it recognizes that the way coaxial, no, the way impedance inverting transformers work. A quarter wavelength of cable is an impedance inverter. If you create a short circuit on a quarter wavelength of transmission line, at the other end of that quarter wavelength of transmission line, you'll see an open circuit. So where your outer bazooka is soldered or connected electronically to your outer shield, a quarter wavelength down, you literally have a short circuit between your sleeve and the outer diameter of the coax cable at that point. It's another kind of coax cable. It's just a large center conductor to the bazooka or the sleeve. There's another center conductor, which happens to be the outer shield of your real coax cable. And the exact impedance between those two is not very critical. The next question somebody will ask is, what's the correct diameter of the sleeve? And almost any diameter will work. You get a slight difference in bandwidth if you make it larger or smaller in diameter. But you've got a short circuit at the bottom end, and at the feed end of your coax cable, the sleeve is a pure open circuit. It's a quarter wavelength away from a short circuit. It presents a pure open circuit to the outer shield of the coax cable. So that's a very convenient balance that I have used. I bet you've used that one a few times, Mel. And how have you constructed it, and what frequency did you use it on? By the way, I think I've got around 35 books on antennas. I've been collecting them for some time. And would you believe I've got 35 years of IEEE antennas and propagation monthly journals? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Guess we got a similar collection. Okay, what I have done back in my early days of 2-meter work, basically, I'll tell you what Dick has just mentioned and all. In fact, I better do it fairly quick. We may have to sort of carry this over. I'd like to, I know, answer these questions. I took two lengths. Now, this is for my 2-meter dipole early days. Took two lengths of coaxial cable, quarter wave long at the frequency. Basically, if you want to know how to make the length of cable, you use the formula simply, length L equals 2, 3, 4, 34 over frequency in megahertz. You take these two pieces of cable. This is, one piece is your feed line, would be your coax, but you measure down this quarter wave down that by using that formula, and then you cut a piece using that formula. So in other words, one piece is your solid piece, the original coax coming down. The other piece, the L equals 234 frequency of megahertz, is the piece that you're going to cut. Now you parallel these two pieces up. Usually you put a little space between them. It's a good idea to have a little space between them, about maybe a half inch or so. And as Dick just said, you take the bottom of the piece that you just cut, you join the two connections together, and you tap into the shield at the at that length on the main coax. Up on top, you take this piece that you just added, that you cut, you join the two pieces together, and you connect it to one side of a dipole. You may also take that side of the dipole that you just connected the two pieces together, and you go to the center of your feed line. And then all you have to do now is take the other half of the dipole and go to the shield of the feed line up at the top. That is basically a very poor man's way of doing it, but very effective, and that's what I use and works out quite well, even though, well, it's 12 o'clock, Dick, so I guess we'll have to let this go over.
Yeah, I'm going to ask for the bottom of the extra piece of coax, a quarter wavelength long. You connect the center conductor and shield together, and join both of them to the shield of the main transmission line. Then at the top of that added thing, did you connect center conductor of added cable to center conductor of original cable? Give me a little bit of a detail. I'll zoom in on that one, Mel, go ahead.
I took the added piece, I connected the two together just as I did on the bottom, went to one end of the dipole, at the same time also joined that point to the center of my feed line, then took the other half of the dipole, and I just connected that only to the shield of the feed line, Dick. Over.
Okay, so what of the auxiliary piece of coax at the top was electrically connected to what of your main transmission line? Go ahead.
Okay, the top of my added piece, tie the two together, shield to the center, and also join it up with the center of the main feed line and one side of the dipole, Dick. Over.
Okay. A little bit unusual. I'm going to think about that one. I haven't seen it used that way. Okay, you guys have listened to TechNet number 1282 of the series that began in September of 1982. Assuming we all stay healthy, we'll be back next week and do more of the same. 73, you all, try to be kind to each other. And bye-bye for now. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW, clear but listening.
This is K2KEY again. I can say I'm sorry. I'll try to coax this little bit of this in. I know we've got a few interesting subjects that I didn't touch upon because they're a little too long-winded for me to tap out on a keyboard at my hunting tech method. So, and the only way is, I could say, bring them up here. Interesting subjects, of course. One of them, I guess, was never even touched upon tonight. Is a simple explanation of receiver published characteristics and things of that sort. Dick, I got a number of those people that have been asking, how do the you know decipher published information by the manufacturer on the on specifications of a receiver? And you know, how many of them are redundant from one manufacturer to another on the same, making the same piece of equipment? Which one would you purchase? You know. By just looking at specification sheets, so can I simply break them down? Because it's too complicated to understand how it, you know, it's printed. So maybe we can get to that next week if you can leave some time for that also. Over.
Okay, why don't we make a promise that unless something really earth-shattering takes place, at 11 o'clock next Sunday, we'll begin discussing receiver specifications.
Link clear.
So next Sunday at 11 o'clock, we'll begin discussing receiver specifications. How's that, Mel? K2RIW?
Hey, why don't we make it this way? Right after Paul's face report, we try to do some of this email. Over.
Also a very good way. Okay. Bye-bye for now. See you next week.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks, Mel. This is KC2SYL listening.
See you later, Bill.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6. Disconnected.
Good morning. This is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:10 a.m. W2VL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 12:16 a.m. Good morning. The time is 12:34 a.m. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. This is the W2 WVL repeater. The time is 12:44 a.m. Good morning. Good morning, W2VL repeater system.